You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Climate deception lawsuits have been brought by states against the big oil and gas companies across the country, but the cases are currently locked in legal battles over whether federal or local judges should hear them. And that was exactly the question before the D.C. Federal Appellate Court. Does the District of Columbia's climate liability lawsuit against ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, and Shell belong in federal court or state court? My guest is environmental law expert Pat Parento, a professor at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. Pat, tell us a little about these so-called climate deception lawsuits.
Yeah, D.C.'s lawsuit is based on its consumer protection law. And there are several other cases. Minnesota, Massachusetts, Connecticut have filed similar cases based on both their state statutes that protect consumers from deceit or fraud, and also common law claims for the same sort of deception. There's another class of cases that's actually bigger. There's more of them that are more classic tort cases. They began as nuisance cases. They've now sort of morphed into deception and failure to warn type cases. So all of these climate liability cases against the oil companies, some of them have included coal. Some of them have even included plastics manufacturers. But the bulk of the cases are suing the big oil companies, the so-called carbon majors. And some of them are seeking compensation, sort of cost recovery for the cost of adapting to what we now see are, you know, onrushing impacts of climate change, sea level rise, storm surge, and so forth. The District of Columbia case is a little different. It's seeking penalties for deception, false advertising, and so forth, greenwashing. And it's also seeking what's called disgorgement of profits. So it's seeking to recover, you know, oil companies have been raking in windfall profits, right, lately. And they're seeking to recover some of those profits to be distributed to consumers. In this case, it would be within the District of Columbia, and the other states would be in those states, as kind of a rebate back to consumers. So fascinating cases all around.
Yeah, so the attorney for D.C. said the claims are based on the deceptive conduct of the fossil fuel companies, not on the emissions or production of fossil fuels. He said, quote, "We have no quarrel in this litigation with their emitting greenhouse gases. We don't even have a quarrel with them marketing their products in the District of Columbia, as long as they don't market their products in a deceptive or misleading way. That's our quarrel in this case." So what's happening here, as in other cases against the fossil fuel industry, they're locked in battles over whether federal or local judges should ultimately hear the merits of these cases. Does his argument go to whether it's federal or local?
Yes, it does. And he's right to the extent that these cases are based strictly in the District of Columbia case. They're based strictly on laws, ordinances that have been enacted by the District of Columbia, which, of course, is not a state. It wants to be, but it's not a state. And so there's no federal connection whatsoever to the claims, the causes of action that the District of Columbia has filed against the oil companies. The oil companies' arguments are completely spurious on that point about where they belong. They belong, in this case, in the District of Columbia court system. There's one thing, though, about what the D.C. lawyer is saying that's not quite 100%. And that is, when it comes to the measure of damages, right, how much are you actually going to charge the company as the damage from the deception? That has to do with the impacts of climate change, which, of course, are related to the emissions. So you see what I mean? There's a little bit of disingenuity here in saying it has nothing to do with emissions. Of course it does. It goes to the question of, if you win your argument, as I think they will, by the way, that the companies have been deceptive and have misled consumers, what's the damage from that? In other words, what would have happened had you not been deceptive? Had you not lied, would things be any different? Would they be any better? Would consumers have stopped buying gas-guzzling cars? Would they have been able to afford electric vehicles? You see what I mean? So when you get into the sort of second phase of these cases, which is what's the real damage from all this, that's when it's going to get very interesting.
So this first phase jurisdiction, what was the industry argument for trying to get this into federal court? Why did they think it should be in federal court? Or why did they say they think it should be in federal court?
Yeah, it's what I call pretzel logic, okay? So the way it works is the oil companies, the defendants claim that these cases, because it's global in nature, again, they're making the argument the case is really about emissions, right? And so they're saying that is classically a question for federal jurisdiction. You can't have 50 states plus the District of Columbia running around filing lawsuits against us. These should be litigated in federal court, because they're interstate and global in nature, the impacts, the damage that you're really talking about here. And then they say, and because there is no federal law, they should all be dismissed. So that's the pretzel logic part of it. First of all, it's governed by federal law, so they belong in federal court. But since there's no federal law, they should be dismissed. And that's where the judges in the D.C. Circuit, and two of them were Trump appointee judges, were scratching their heads and saying, wait a minute, how can this be right? How can you be saying, first there is federal law and then federal law disappears? I don't get it. So I'm predicting that the D.C. Circuit is going to send this case back to the District of Columbia Court.
So explain why the industry is fighting tooth and nail to force these cases into federal court, why they want them in federal court.
They want a fast track to the Supreme Court. They want to get these cases back in front of the Supreme Court and tossed out completely. That's what they're shooting for. And they don't ever want to go to trial. They don't want to have any depositions. They don't want to have any discovery. They want to try to spike these cases. They tried to get the Supreme Court to take an appeal from this other class of cases I mentioned, these more tort-based, nuisance-based kinds of cases, but the Supreme Court just recently said, no thanks, we're not going to look at them right now. Maybe later, but right now we're staying out of it.
And has the industry basically struck out in these cases? I think the D.C. District Court judge, there were at least 13 other district court judges and five appeals courts that dismissed.
They've lost them all. Yeah. The defendant oil companies have lost every single attempt to move these cases into federal court.
Are any of the cases moving forward? I read that the first one of these was brought by Coastal California Communities in 2017.
Yeah. The case that's in front right now, interestingly, is Honolulu. And in Honolulu, the state court judge has already denied. The case was sent back from federal court to state court in Hawaii. And the Hawaii state court judge has already denied the oil company's motion to dismiss based on the argument that these claims are preempted by federal law. There's two different federal doctrines going on here, and it gets very confusing, I'm sure. One is whether the Clean Air Act has displaced federal common law, which would otherwise govern sort of interstate pollution problems, right? But the other doctrine that the companies are arguing is that the Clean Air Act also preempts state law. That's one that the Supreme Court is ultimately going to have to decide, I predict.
In several of these cases, appeals courts have ruled twice to affirm the state courts are the right venue. At what point does discovery start? I mean, how long can they keep litigating the jurisdictional issue?
They've run their string on that. And the Hawaii judges are poised to start discovery. There's a petition pending in the Hawaii Supreme Court, which is their sort of last gasp effort to prevent discovery. But again, my colleagues at the University of Hawaii Law School, who know their court very well, are pretty confident that the Hawaii Supreme Court is not going to stop the cases and that discovery is probably going to get underway in Hawaii this year.
Do we think the industry is afraid of discovery, very afraid of discovery, incredibly afraid of discovery?
Yeah, somewhere along that spectrum, they're very afraid because, you know, now you're talking about subpoenaing former, you know, CEOs of Exxon and BP and Shell, all the rest, putting them under oath and asking them very pointed questions about what did you know, when did you know it, what did you do with the information, why does your advertising say one thing when your internal documents say something else, why are you filing securities reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission that are not fully disclosing the risks and the dangers that you knew about. In fact, one of the more recent studies of what the companies knew concluded company scientists knew more than government scientists about the dangers of climate change earlier than some of the international organizations like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change knew. So all of this is going to come out. It's going to become public. And it's going to go into evidence in front of a jury. And that's what they're terrified about.
Pat, is there any way that, or the number's too great for the industry to settle some of these cases?
I think some of the defendants, you know, there's a range of culpability here. Exxon's the worst. From everything that we've seen, documents that have been released, statements that have been made, et cetera, Exxon is really the ringleader of the deception campaign and organizing even the American Petroleum Institute and others to carry out this propaganda of deceit. We don't know very much about climate change, still a lot of unanswered questions, still a lot of research needed and so forth. But some of the other companies are sort of less egregious in their conduct. They might try to peel off and settle. Yeah, that happened with the tobacco cases. Some of the tobacco companies decided, you know, stop the bleeding and let's get out of these cases. And that could happen in these cases.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Pat. That's Professor Patrick Parento of the Vermont Law and Graduate School.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Another setback for federal prosecutors in their efforts to pursue charges of public corruption against state and local officials. The Supreme Court threw out two fraud convictions during former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration, one involving Joseph Percoco, a former campaign manager and longtime confidant to Cuomo. During the oral arguments, justices from across the court's ideological spectrum had expressed concern that the government's position would put influential lobbyists and those who hire them at risk of prosecution. Here are Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Elena Kagan.
So it sounds like that's an effort to break down the concept of political power.
You're proposing a test which, as the Chief Justice suggested, doesn't need to have any of that. You don't have to be a former official. You don't need to be a future official. I don't think you can give me that test without making it look like the guy's just a really, really good lobbyist.
These are part of a long line of Supreme Court cases that criticize federal prosecutors for overreaching in public corruption cases, dating from tossing the conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell in 2016 to tossing the convictions of two political allies of former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in 2020 in the Bridgegate scandal. Joining me is Nicole English, a former state court judge and federal prosecutor. She's currently a partner at Dorsey & Whitney. Tell us about the case against Percoco.
So Joseph Percoco was a former aide to then-Governor Cuomo, and he was charged and convicted of conspiracy to commit honest services fraud. And that was from the time when he was no longer working for Governor Cuomo as an aide, but at the time he was serving in a campaign capacity. And at that time, he received some money, $35,000, from a development company who wanted to avoid this, you know, costly union-related requirement. And he used his influence, basically, to get rid of that requirement.
So was his argument at the Supreme Court basically that he was a lobbyist during that time or not an employee of the state?
His primary argument was that he was charged under a particular statute that requires the government to show that the person charged has in some way engaged in not serving the public with their honest services. And what he argued is that because he didn't work for the government at the time of this particular charge, he couldn't owe a duty to the public to provide honest services, so this charge needed to be overturned.
Tell us what the Supreme Court decided and why.
The Supreme Court decided that if a person is going to be charged with honest services fraud, they wouldn't necessarily have to be someone who works for the government in order for an honest services charge to be sustained, but there needed to be a pretty close tie-in. So in other words, if a person is going to be charged with honest services fraud, they could be somebody who has authority delegated to them as an actual agent of the government. But somebody who is merely a private citizen cannot be charged with that crime.
How did they handle the fact that even though he was working on the campaign, he still had access to his offices and continued to use them to conduct business? Did they touch on that?
They didn't consider any of those activities to be sufficient because they were concerned that as a private citizen, he could have more or less been acting like a lobbyist, and they were concerned that the statute was being applied in an overly broad way, and it could encompass people who have legitimate lobbying activities, getting paid to, you know, seek redress from the government. And so the concern was that if he was found guilty of honest services fraud, then the statute could apply to people who are doing legitimate lobbying activities.
This decision, I don't think, came as a surprise to many people. Explain how the Supreme Court has narrowed the reach of these federal corruption laws in recent years.
This definitely was not a surprise, and I think it's telling that by the time the case got to oral argument, the government itself had basically conceded that in each of these cases that the fraud statutes were overly broad and wouldn't have applied. And the government tried to save them by arguing some different theories that they hadn't raised below. So it was definitely not a surprise. The Supreme Court, going back to its McNally decision in 1987, has made it clear that these federal fraud statutes don't authorize federal prosecutors to define what's, you know, good government means for state and local officials. So the fraud statutes don't criminalize all acts of dishonesty or corruption. And instead, the Supreme Court has made it clear that the federal fraud statutes are limited to protecting property rights. And the only exception is for what's called honest services. That's the charge at issue in Prococo. But since the Supreme Court's decision in 2010 in Skilling, honest services cases themselves have been limited to those that involve, you know, traditional bribes or kickbacks. And now, after Prococo, of course, honest services cases need to involve a government employee or someone, you know, acting as an actual agent of the government. And what McNally and Skilling and other cases since then have provided is that the justices are very concerned about federalism and overreach. So they're worried, as Justice Kagan said in the 2020 decision in Kelly versus United States, the New Jersey Bridgegate scandal case, that if left unchecked, the federal government could use criminal law to enforce its own view of integrity in broad swaths of state and local policymaking. And they're also concerned, the justices are, that fraud statutes could reach legitimate activities like paid lobbyists who don't owe a duty to the public and who are legitimately getting paid to petition the government.
Why do you think those ideas cut across ideological lines on the court?
I think it's really interesting that most of these cases have been unanimous or nearly unanimous. And as you say, they do cross ideological lines, which is not something that we see very often. And I think the reason behind that is the liberal justices tend to be very skeptical of criminal laws that don't clearly put people on notice of the behavior that is criminal. So that's often known as the doctrine of lenity, that if a criminal statute is somewhat ambiguous or open to different interpretations, it should be interpreted in a way that is most beneficial to the criminal defendant. Conservative justices believe also in the rule of lenity, the same as liberal justices, but they also emphasize how Congress should not let unelected prosecutors and judges decide what should be criminal. And they are, you know, more sensitive to First Amendment issues, as we've seen in cases like Citizens United and others, in which the conservative justices are more sympathetic to the idea that money and politics could well be for legitimate purposes.
In the concurring opinion, Justice Gorsuch said the court should have gone further and defined precisely when a duty of providing honest services arose. With all these cases, why hasn't the court actually done that? Why leave it ambiguous?
Right. Well, the court feels that it's not the court's job to define what a criminal statute should provide. It's Congress's job. They end up doing it case by case on the facts of the case presented to them, but the general principle is that's for the legislature to do.
So now this goes back to the federal court, and this was based on the jury instruction. So possibly could he be tried again on these?
It seems that the court may have left that possibility open, but that remains to be seen on whether there's any possibility of retrying either of these defendants. The various theories that the government argued in the appellate case are ones that were not presented below. So the case has been remanded, and it remains to be seen whether it could be retried.
They only reversed on some of the convictions, right? He still has other convictions in place?
That's correct. And there's quite a lot of things still left. He was convicted of a count of bribery with respect to some other payments. And to my understanding, he served his time in prison and has been released.
what's the future for these kinds of prosecutions of public corruption?
To a large extent, what the Supreme Court is saying is their preference is to leave this up to the state prosecution system. I don't think that's necessarily a good idea because the federal system is uniquely better situated to handle public corruption cases. As somebody who worked in both the federal system and the state system, the federal system has the requisite resources to handle public corruption. These kinds of cases take a lot of resources. They typically involve multiple agencies, a fair amount of time in front of the grand jury, the use of insiders, cooperators. The state system, in contrast, is a bit overwhelmed, I would say, in most jurisdictions, and it's dominated by violent crime cases and drug cases. And typically, local law enforcement doesn't have, you know, the time or the expertise to handle these kinds of cases. And there's also the issue of how does a state or local authority investigate what might be a counterpart in a state or local agency. So it really does make sense for public corruption cases to be brought federally. But the problem identified in these cases by the Supreme Court is that the key statutes prosecutors typically rely on, mail and wire fraud, were not designed for these cases. So after this, if you aren't going to bring these cases in state court, which I don't think is a good idea, chances are the federal prosecutors will need to find a way to have their case fit, you know, within the property fraud statutes or the honest services statute. The Supreme Court has given some guidance on how future corruption cases might survive after these cases. In Percoco, prosecutors will need to apply common law agency principles when they're bringing honest services fraud theories. And in a case involving a private citizen, after Simonelli, prosecutors will need to stick more closely to traditional property theories when bringing mail and wire fraud cases. So they really will need to show that there is a scheme to defraud another out of money or property. Or another option is for prosecutors to find one of the existing statutes, not the fraud statute, but the others that might fit the conduct more closely, things like the Hobbs Act, the Travel Act, the federal program bribery statute, and others.
Any final thoughts?
Even though these cases look like the court is just antagonistic towards public corruption prosecutions, that's not really what these cases are about. These cases are about the court's concern about federalism, about the idea that federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, and also about their concerns regarding due process and the rule of lenity, that if a statute has any ambiguity, it should be construed in a way most favorable to the defendant.
Thanks so much for being on the show. That's Nicole Engish, a former Minnesota state court judge and federal prosecutor. She's currently a partner at Dorsey & Whitney. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.